We were delighted to call upon our colleague Chris Pugsley to come and talk to us about another important topic, and that is military leadership. And of course, many of you will know Chris is a real expert, particularly on some of these individuals that he's going to quiz you on in the minute. So without further ado, Chris, please come and tell us. Well, do you want to run your quiz first and then?
No, we're good.
All right, mate.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much, Joe. Thank you very much for the invitation. Can you hear me at the back?
Yeah.
All right. Given that it was the 175th, and in fact the New Zealand Army was formally formed in the 50s, wasn't it? 49?
Yeah.
50? Something like that. Under the Army Act, but still. If you can find a date, you can always tag something to it. I thought, though, given the nature of what this talk was going to be, that we would look at New Zealand command in war. And I don't think there is such a thing as a national trade that guarantees command success. The bedrock is universal, and a degree of luck comes into it if the right individuals emerge. And given the state of preparedness, we were very lucky in both world wars in terms of the individuals that came to the fore. let's do the quiz first. Who are we looking at? Who's this? Let me just switch this on. I can. Who's this chap? First New Zealander to command a division on operations in the First World War, Richard Hutton Davies, outstanding field commander in the Boer War, commanded the New Zealand Brigade of the last three contingents in the Boer War, sent for staff experience to Britain, where he commanded 6th Brigade at Aldershot, was due to come home in October 1914, was seen as Godley's successor in taking over the New Zealand Defence Forces. However, the outbreak of war saw him take 6th Brigade to war with the British Expeditionary Force. Great height, 5'6", same height as me, so I have an affinity with this man. But insisted on marching with his troops in the retreat from Mons and the Battle of Lakato, exhausted, relieved of his command, went back and given command of the 20th Light Division when it was formed, took it to France, but his health broke down, took over the Cannock Chase training area where the Rifle Brigade trained, however, broke down both in health and mentally, relieved of his command in early 1916, felt that the war had sidelined him, and he committed suicide in May 1918, and committed suicide in May 1918. Who's this next chap? Godley, all right, yes. Outstanding administrator and trainer. Suspect as a divisional commander and very suspect as a corps commander, but important in establishing and setting up the administration of the New Zealand Territorial Force. Who's this? Fiery Ted Chaytor. And when you think commander of the New Zealand Mounted Rifle Brigade, permanent staff, New Zealand Staff Corps, outstanding soldier in the Boer War, badly wounded on Gallipoli, that did nothing for his sense of humour, particularly when you put him on a horse, because had been shot in the thigh, but Sinai Palestine, superb brigade commander. And when Chevelle is promoted to command the desert mounted column, Chaytor commands the Anzac mounted division. And when you think there's three quite senior Australian light horse brigade commanders, Chevelle picks his best man, and that's Chaytor. And of course in 1918, commands Chaytor force in Jericho, which is the major feint in Allenby's final offensive. Becomes GOC of the New Zealand defences post-war, but a superb fighting commander. And had the war continued, Russell had recommended that Chaytor take over the New Zealand division, but time didn't allow that. Guy in the centre, I've already mentioned him, Andrew Russell. I'll talk to Andrew Russell today. Next to him, the coloured portrait is the clue, the Peter McIntyre painter. It's obviously... obviously. Next door to him, who's that?
Captain Bigger.
No, it's not. It's Barraclough, Commander 3rd Division. Once again, as Freyberg regarded commanding 6th Brigade, outstanding performance, City Rezek. Freyberg saw Barraclough as his successor, should anything happen to him in command of the division. And on the outbreak of the war with Japan, he was nominated to go back and would eventually command 3 New Zealand division in the Pacific. And on those amphibious operations and with his liaison with the Pacific Command, proved that Freyberg's recommendations were justified. As that proved, our forgotten divisional commander. And who's the smiley-faced guy on the side?
Stephen Weir.
That's it. Sir Stephen Weir. What division did he command? Real test. Let's see who the train spotters are here. After reached a point where when Freyberg is injured in that plane crash, Weir takes over command of the New Zealand division, then becomes Corps Commander of Royal Artillery, and then commands 46th British Division, the only New Zealander to command a division outside of the New Zealand defence structure in the Second World War. And so so we'll look at, as I said, Russell and Freyberg, but some other names have popped up. Anyone I know who that is? Edward Puttock. Divisional commander in Crete, superb brigadier, very effective in Greece, but couldn't step up in Crete. Could see every problem, but couldn't make a decision. Whiskey Bill Ingalls, almost destroyed the New Zealand division at Ruwaiza and Almeria. Once again, outstanding brigade commander during the Crusader operations, but less so in command of the division. And Freyberg ensured that he never had operational control of the New Zealand division ever again. And Chapon, I like that photo because Upham's in it as well. Who's that? Kippenberger. And of course, commands the division while the New Zealand Corps was formed at the time of Casino, and then when he loses his legs, who takes over? Anyone know who that is? Ike Parkinson commands the New Zealand division at the time of Casino. And finally, Stephen Weir that I've spoke to. And it's interesting. Superb brigadiers, but when it comes to the ultimate command in New Zealand terms, Puttock, no. Ingalls, no. Kippenberger, question mark. Because he's seen, in terms of his brigade command and his adoption of the Dickens plan, as potentially the one who could carry out the Casino operation with all its difficulties to some success. But we don't know. Just at the point where we were going to see one way or the other, fate and the nature of war intervene. Parkinson showed his limitations in the fighting at Osonia just before Casino and demonstrated that full well during his conduct of Dickens at Casino. All right, but let's have a look at two exemplars where we were very lucky indeed in the caliber of the people we had. Hamilton, Andrew Russell, New Zealand Divisional Commander, 16 to early 19, 1868 Napier. So when he goes to war, he's 46 in 1914. Follows the family tradition, Harrow and Sandhurst. 5 years as a subaltern in the Border Regiment in Burma and India. Resigns his commission to go sheep farming, Tinu Nui, family property in the Hawke's Bay, always keen on the Territorial Force. Formation of the Territorial Force is the Wellington Mounted Rifle Brigade Commander, and conscious, very conscious, of how much we don't know. And private library, interesting man, fluent in German, practiced the cello. So you need people like that. And then Commander New Zealand Mounted Rifles Brigade on the formation of the NZEF in 1914. And succeeds Godley in command of the mixed New Zealand and Australian division on Gallipoli. The one man who emerges from the Gallipoli campaign with an outstanding reputation, commands the rear guard on Gallipoli at Anzac in the evacuation, and then GOC of the New Zealand Division, commanding the New Zealand Division from 1916 to 1919, raises it and commands it. And Harrington, Plumer's CGS, chief of, had this comment, which Russell adopted: the backbone of command, leadership, and effective combat application is trust, training, and thoroughness. The soldiers have to trust that in their training and in the planning and in what you tell them, that the plan will succeed and they have a chance of getting through it alive. Training. Train at every level. Bedrock, and as we will see, the First World War sees the evolution of platoon level tactics. Small group tactics, section, platoon, company fire and movement, and the application of all arms. All that evolves, but whether it happens or not depends on the leadership you've got. And thoroughness. It's a two-way process. you've got a brilliant enemy who's regarded as the Roger Federer of armies in the First World War. In terms of their staff duties, their command application, and their professionalism, second to none. So you've got to be bloody good to beat them. And we started this war as amateurs. And Hamilton, Andrew Russell is well aware of that. There's Andrew Russell in the centre. He's talking to his officers. He didn't have a nickname other than the General, because he was a steely, flinty individual who demanded perfection. And if a man wasn't up to commanding men, you got rid of him. And I like the fact that it's Young's 2nd Brigade. There's Bobby Young, a dentist from Martin. And he had 7 children. So Mrs. Young was very pleased he went off to war. The New Zealand division on the Western Front was one of some 50 to 60 divisions in the British Expeditionary Force. When it goes, it's part, as you see there, at the top. Oh, let's go. Big fingers. Haig, 5 armies, each of a number of corps, and initially 2 Anzac corps. But the time I'm going to look at, 1918, that's the Anzac corps. The Australians have formed an Australian corps. Godley ends up commanding a British corps, 23rd corps, and the New Zealanders, as they have done in 1916 on the Somme, and again on the Somme in 1918, find themselves under a British corps commander. And so, in many respects, unlike the Australians and the Canadians, Russell's New Zealand division is treated like a British division. It ends up where it's needed, and it fights 1918 as part of Daddy Harper's 4 Corps. And it's 3rd Army, 4 Corps. Whoop-de-doo, I've really blown it this time. I pressed something. Ah, there we are. And the New Zealand division, 3 brigades, the Rifle Brigade. In 1918, the Rifle Brigade is the weakest of the 3 brigades. And you've got the North Island Brigade, 1st Brigade, and the South Island Brigade, 2nd Brigade. And from the Somme, New Zealand's first battle in 1916, learning experience, saved by the caliber of the soldier rather than the ability of the commanders. And Russell was very aware of that. And there's Russell doing his inspections in the winter of 1617, and bedrock that both Russell and Freyberg believed in. The quality of the administration is critical. And he learns that lesson on the Somme and applies it religiously from then on. And Freyberg's one published work pre-Second World War is a book on administration. So administration is the bedrock, and that junior leadership are trained for the job they have to do. This was a platoon commander's war, because to take the blockhouse or a piece of a trench is the first piece of the jigsaw puzzle. And by 1918, that trust, training, and thoroughness is summed up by Russell in a letter to Allen, the New Zealand Minister of Defence, in terms of how effective the training has been and the rebuilding of the division after the failures of Passchendaele in October 1917. And can you read that?
Yeah.
Everyone got that? Mm. I've got so much to say. Anyway, he believes his division in March 18 is ready for combat and trained for it. He's trained it at all levels for mobile operations because that's what he anticipates. And there are his brigadiers. Hubert Hart, Masterton lawyer, farmer, first territorial brigadier. Simon, artillery, not CRA, but senior New Zealander in the division in the artillery. Russell himself, Daddy Young, and Melville, captain, regular force, and will become GOC New Zealand Division after the war, as will Young. All company commanders or captains in 1914-15, now brigadiers. And the subalterns of 14 are the commanding officers. And Russell's 2IC. George Napier Johnston, a cool relationship between Russell and Johnston, but Johnston, when it comes to artillery, is the consummate professional. And he matches Russell in his determination to get things right. And 1918, for the New Zealand Division, a year of hard fighting, thrown in. That's big fingers again. Let's do it. Thrown in to hold the gap at Ballymolloy, Collincamp, and then the advance of the New Zealand Division up to Lekenwa, and that final bit in the 2 days, 4th, 5th, and November 1918. And learnt from the German tactics, even though largely followed in 17, the lessons were not forgotten. Stormtroop tactics, small group, confirmed what the British were doing in terms of their small group, section fire and manoeuvre, platoon fire and manoeuvre was right. And Haig kept visiting Russell because he regarded him as an outstanding divisional commander. Haig, in fact, offers Russell command of a British corps, the only Dominion commander to be offered a corps command, which he turns down because he recognises that it won't be a good corps, and he won't have a division the calibre of the New Zealand Division. And Russell bypass, move on, avoid casualties. Villages, towns are obstacles, not ends in themselves. So he's thinking how to use his brigades effectively. And they're trained for the job they have to do. And I don't know if you can read that. Arthur Berend, a view from Kemmel Hill, is adjutant of a heavy 6-inch regiment which finds itself in support to the New Zealand Division throughout 1918. For no words of mine can convey to the layman the feeling of heaven when an artilleryman knows when the division he is supporting is a good one. And of all the good and very good divisions of the British Army, I would rate the New Zealand Division high among the highest. And so, and that's not a general giving puffery, that's a practical soldier considering how good is the division he's supporting. And, oh, look at that. Didn't check the colours. Sorry about that. However, look at the bottom line. 18,700 casualties
in 1918. Hard fighting. 5,222 dead.
Speaks for itself. And that's within the overall New Zealand figure. And won't go into the organisation, but look how, if, hey, look at my Le Quesnoy book, I stole it from there. This is the only commercial break that you'll have. But it's a sophisticated organisation that knows its job. And backed by trained reinforcements. And if you think how they were scraping the barrel in the British Army, in every army, by 1918, the New Zealand Division alone is getting its 2,000 reinforcements. Its divisional strength just before the final battle of Le Quesnoy is 18,336. It's up to strength, except for 4 brigade. It's got a reinforcement pool in France and in the UK of close to 10,000. That's as many or more than the entire Australian Corps. In fact, the Australian Corps are reduced now to battalions of 300 bands. So you can keep fighting if you can keep reinforcing. And that was the case with the New Zealand Division. Very quickly, let's have a look at Le Quesnoy, because it shows Russell and his division at its peak. The last formal battle on the Western Front, and it's not a battle to take a town, it's a battle to bypass one of Vauban's fantastic fortresses. And if you haven't been to Le Quesnoy, you gotta go. But it's up here is the Forest de Montmartre, and beyond that is the Sambre River. And the battle is to get through the forest to the river and seize the crossings. And Russell, there we are, big fingers again. Let's go back. Wants to bypass. God, look at this. What did I do? There we are. We're back. Wants to bypass Le Quesnoy, avoiding casualties. And it's all right, the lady upstairs doing a bit of yoga, I'm just joining in. It's part of a 15 division attack on a 3-army front, and the New Zealand division ends up attacking or bypassing the cork in the bottle. And let's see how Russell does it. First of all, Johnston provides a sophisticated fire plan. The only artillery that lands in the town knocks down the town hall's spire, so it denies German observation. And look at this. 7 artillery brigades, 168 guns, including heavies, 2 special Royal Engineer companies firing first generation napalm onto the city walls to smoke off the German defenders, 6-inch mortars and 3 trench light trench mortar batteries walking forward with the attacking infantry. And all to a sophisticated program. First of all, smoking off the town, knocking down the church, the town hall spire with the minimum collateral damage, as the Americans would say, and then 2 rolling barrages, one in the north to keep pace with the British advance to the north, and Oh, look at that, who did this? There we are, up to the green line. I couldn't get it to stop. And one in the south to keep pace with the British division in the south. Oh, bugger. Up to the green line. Once again, stop. Oh yeah, not too bad. And then, once they hit the green line, look at this thing. Uh-oh. A combined barrage covering the divisional front up to and beyond to the red dotted line. Wow. And you can't read that, I'm sorry. I'll make it a lighter colour next time. That time program for the gunners, and they're leapfrogging the guns forward at the same time, is for 388 minutes. Now, picture that gun firing that program with those gunners for that time. It speaks for itself. 168 guns and the move forward. And around that, that's one part of the cooperation of all arms. Around that, you've got the infantry. The weakest brigade, Hart's rifle brigade, is tasked by Russell to surround Le Quesnoy. Avoid casualties, don't enter the town, mask it so the other brigades can push on. And look at this, wow. Here we are, the four battalions of the rifle brigade move up and start the envelopment of the town. Haven't quite got enough, so one brigade sends one Auckland to help, and both Wellington battalions then secure the green line. And watch how the envelopment takes place. Oh, one Auckland closes up, and three rifles close up, and Le Quesnoy is secure. Tactically, it's no longer of any importance, but a worry to the 1,100 Germans in the town who are hoping that God will intervene or there will be a counterattack. Yeah, sorry, I'll speed it up because we won't. All right, there we are. What's the time now? Oh, okay, well, this is going to be a very fast second episode. And so there you have the infantry coordination of two brigades. Up the do. And there's Barraclough's fourth rifles on their start line. And of course, they feature in the one episode for which Le Quesnoy is remembered, getting over the wall. But the battle goes on. And that's in the forest itself. And you see the Wellingtons and the Ork are pushing through up to the edge of the forest. And Russell's report attacks very successfully. They capture all the German divisional artillery, take hundreds of prisoners, but most importantly, push through the forest towards the river to get the crossings. And that's the name of the game. And then on the 5th, Young's 2nd Brigade continues the advance with the South Island battalions, and at midnight, a British organisation, a division takes over, but the New Zealand artillery stay forward, providing covering fire until the 9th. And so the last battle, when you look at all the moving parts and what's involved, shows Russell and his New Zealanders at its peak. And we remember it for that act, Avril and Kerr going over the wall, Avril at the top, Barraclough's IO. But the reality is, as far as Russell was concerned, he had secured the crossings, and the least tactically significant aspect of this was getting over a wall of a fortress whose garrison couldn't go anywhere anyway, because the front line was now 10 or 12 kilometres behind where they were. And so let me do a race through for Freiburg and the senior operation. And it will be very fast, and I apologise, I always talk too much. By 45, he's regarded as the outstanding divisional British Commonwealth divisional commander in certainly in the Mediterranean, but I think in the British armies as a whole. Because what you have, Montgomery, Lees, everyone who has Freiburg under his command praises his fighting abilities. In fact, Montgomery wants to take him first to Sicily. He can't, because the New Zealand government at this stage hasn't decided whether they'll stay on in the Mediterranean. And then when Montgomery is shifted to Britain to plan for Overlord, he wants the New Zealand division as one of his invasion divisions for Normandy. And once again, that's politically unacceptable as far as the New Zealand government is concerned. And so, but as Steve Weir said, he is the master of what infantry could or could not do. And by 1945, his all-arms New Zealand brigades are, as he terms it, miniature panzer divisions, something of a nature of a small division of all arms. And so, in a sense, the next generation on from Russell, he's seeking the same thing. He wants a division with mobile hitting power, trained so its infantry can march 25 miles in a day and then fight and mount a deliberate attack at the end of it. And integrated with tanks under command and artillery. And you can see the quote at the bottom. And there's Freiburg and his brigadiers in the Western Desert. And he's under notice after Greece and Crete. Fraser, the Prime Minister, wants to see whether or not he should be replaced. Auchinleck and Wavell recommend his qualities, and he stays on under sufferance. And before every major operation, he has to assure the New Zealand government that there's the resources and the planning there to do the job. Trust, training, thoroughness. And the New Zealand division is originally an infantry division, and Freiburg wants an armoured brigade, and it's eventually agreed that a brigade will be trained in New Zealand and come out and join the division. And in a series of disastrous battles, really for New Zealand in terms of casualties, where they're thrown in to fix other people's mistakes in Operation Crusader, and then on the Egyptian frontier, Freiburg is frustrated at the British willingness to disperse their force and not fight their divisions as a division. And he trains for combined operations. Oop-de-doo, let's do that again. And at Alamein, we see that put into effect now with armour, British armour under command. But because of Japan's entry in the war, we're down to two infantry brigades, under strength in infantry, but at least with attached armour. In 1943, the New Zealand government has decided that the New Zealand division would remain in the Mediterranean, and 4th Brigade has, because of its casualties on the Alamein line, has re-rolled as an armoured brigade. And there's the structure, two infantry brigades and one armoured brigade for Italy, two light in infantry, as Freiburg recognises. I won't talk to the various battles because I've got 3 minutes to finish. But the British commanders see the New Zealand division as a mobile strike force. And that was going to be its role as the New Zealand Corps at Casino. And it shows, really, its capabilities in the final advance on the Pola Line in Florence. And marvellous, because ammunition is in short supply because of Overlord. As Freiburg tells his corps commander, no ammunition, no attack. And the New Zealand division are firing 18,000 rounds of artillery ammunition a day. And San Michele, lovely little village to walk through, about three tennis courts in size, absorbs about 54,000 rounds of ammunition over the three-day battle. So, but amazingly, there's some houses still there. And in 45, Freiburg has restructured his division because, like Russell, he realizes reinforcements keep the beast alive. And all long servicemen have been replaced. Three div from the Pacific have sent out trained NCOs, and all other ranks who have served up until October 43. So in essence, apart from command, it's a new division. And he reorganizes it to increase infantry strength. As he says, it's a new division. And we'll see it there. He has taken the divisional cavalry, turns it into infantry. The machine gun battalion, 27 battalion, turns it into infantry. And the motorized battalion, 22nd battalion, and turned it into infantry, and it's 9th brigade. And so at last, he's got what he wanted in 1941. An armored brigade of three regiments, and each of those regiments are attached to one of the British, to one of the New Zealand brigades. And in the Battle of the Senio, there is no guarantee that Russell's New Zealanders will have the New Zealand leading role. But Freiburg's planning, where he wants six bridges across the river lines to get his tanks across and his motorized elements, gives him the lead that he never loses. And that combination, and you can see the gun support, crocodile tanks firing napalm, quarter of a million artillery shells, all ensure that the New Zealand division take the lead that it never loses. And if you follow, you apologize about that, but that's the New Zealand line. And when they cross the Po, you'll find that the New Zealand division is the only operational formation of the 8th Army operating north of the Po, with the Americans. Look at that. There we are. Let's go back a bit. With the Americans to the north. And so, an outstanding performance. And if you've seen Jennifer Mallinson's book, on touring Italy, once they sort out this virus that's going around, it's worth following that route, because Trieste is a lovely place to end a war in, as the New Zealanders found out. And these words could apply as much to Russell as to Freiburg. New Zealand's success its commander. No good or bad battalions, only good or bad commanding officers. Applies to a brigade, applies to a division. Concentration of force, divisional command, coordinated effort, training at all levels, effective trained reinforcements, a soldier's shelf life in war is 9 months. So every 9 months, 100% reinforcements. If you look at the figures for the New Zealand Division in the First World War, how many years of war were there? We mobilized 100,000 men. And mission command. Freiburg set the template, and his people were trained, knew his plan, and could operate comfortably within it. Thank you very much.